From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, three cardiologists sue the DMC, claiming they were forced out for complaining about quality of care issues and unnecessary surgeries.
And they say that some patients actually died. So these are very serious accusations.
Using theater as a tool for social justice, a new play about the Flint water crisis.
When you break it down, it's a play about us taking things for granted, even a cup of water.
Keeping small-town newspapers alive.
I really feel like having a newspaper helps us keep an identity as an independent community.
And a chef explores the intersection of food and culture in Dearborn.
When you look at a dish and you see who made it and you get to talk to that person and you hear their stories, it makes the dish taste better.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. And now the news. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the past 15 years, 1,400 newspapers across this country have gone out of business. What do we lose when local newspapers shut down?
There are issues that I don't think people would even be aware of, or at least to a much more limited extent, if it wasn't in the newspaper every week.
Later this hour, we'll talk with an editor and publisher from two small-town newspapers in southeast Michigan. But first, he was the top cardiologist at the Detroit Medical Center, the founder of the DMC Heart Hospital that opened in 2014. But now Dr. Ted Schreiber is suing DMC. He claims he lost his job because he complained about alleged fraud and quality of care problems at DMC. He follows two other cardiologists in suing the health system for similar reasons. Karen Bouffard has been reporting on the problems at the Detroit Medical Center. Karen, we spoke with you in August 2016 about your investigation into DMC's long history of surgeries plagued by dirty and missing instruments or equipment. And now here comes these three physician lawsuits. What are the accusations these three cardiologists are leveling at DMC and its owner, Tenet?
Well, actually, it was Dr. Schreiber and three of the health system's top cardiologists that all were forced out of their jobs. And they say that they were forced out of their jobs because of complaints that they made about quality of care issues at the health system, including dirty surgical instruments, but actually going beyond that. In the lawsuits that were filed last week by Dr. Mahir Elder and Dr. Amir Kaki, as well as the one that was filed yesterday by Dr. Ted Schreiber, they're really making allegations of fraud as well, including unnecessary surgeries that they say were performed with a profit-making motive at DMC Sinai Grace Hospital and Harper University Hospital, some of which they say were performed by physicians who were not competent to perform them, dangerous procedures, and they say that some patients actually died. So these are very serious accusations.
And then we're fitting pieces together here and walking through this kind of thicket of developments. Last week, you reported that the federal government has told DMC Harper Hospital it has to pass an inspection by April 15th or it will lose its federal Medicare funding, and Sinai Grace Hospital better pass an inspection by August 31st or lose its funding. What's going on here? What kind of quality of care issues did inspectors find?
Well, they found at Harper University Hospital they were substantially out of compliance with infection control procedures. During an inspection in October, they found things like flies that were flying around an intensive care unit, healthcare providers that were not properly attired, lots of dirty surgical instruments, but lots of problems that have to do with, you know, cleanliness and the condition of the facility and so forth. So, and then at Sinai Grace was actually out of compliance for most of 2018 after failing several inspections. The two issues there were the condition of the facility and some significant problems there with fire protection safety and things like that, but also they were found substantially out of compliance with regard to the quality of the nursing care program, especially wound care. So Sinai Grace did end up passing an inspection and in August and was redeemed. You know, it had its deemed status returned in September. But then the Detroit News reported in January about a woman that had she arrived at the emergency room at Sinai Grace during a power outage over Thanksgiving, and they were not able to provide cardiac catheterization procedure that could have possibly have saved her life. And the woman subsequently died after being transferred to another hospital. So that prompted another inspection of Sinai Grace. And so they are, again, out of compliance and in danger of termination in August if they don't fix those problems. So the imminent situation is at Harper University Hospital, because of course they have to pass an inspection by April 15th or they will lose their Medicare funding. In Michigan, if a hospital loses its accreditation or its status with the Medicare program, they are not able to access Medicaid funding either. So those are two federal programs that together provide 85% of the funding for inpatient hospital beds at Harper Hospital. So that would be a significant blow to Harper as well as to the entire Detroit Medical Center health system.
And for patients, I'm wondering if you know, let's say that April 15th deadline comes and Harper University Hospital doesn't get these problems fixed and it loses this funding. What might that ultimately mean for low-income people who rely on Medicaid for their health care?
I don't think there's an easy answer to that question. It's very rare for a hospital to lose its Medicare accreditation. I mean, across the country, it's, you know, very, very rare. I don't think we really know at this point whether the hospital would stop providing services or if they would continue to take patients and just hope that the funding comes through eventually. You know, I really don't know the answer to that question.
Back to these three physician lawsuits. What is DMC's response to these lawsuits, Karen?
Well, they absolutely insist that these doctors were let go for violations of the health system's code of conduct, but they have not said what those violations are. The physicians have not received copies of the report that the health system compiled against them. The report was actually compiled by a law firm that was hired to investigate them. So these physicians don't know specifically what they're accused of. The health system maintains, though, that they did violate the health system's code of conduct, and that's why they were let go.
When I remember talking to you when your investigation in August of 2016 exposed this history of these problems with dirty surgical instruments, I remember we talked about dried blood, you know, cost cutting and supposed streamlining had contributed to just things not being done well. Weren't there a lot of promises made at that point about things were going to be fixed?
Yes, and I think that the overriding issue across the complaints that were filed both by Dr. Mihir Elder and Dr. Kaki last week and the one filed by Dr. Ted Schreiber yesterday, the overriding issue is really that cost cutting has been a force for, you know, with some negative consequences at the DMC since it was purchased by Tenet Healthcare, which is a for-profit hospital chain that is based in Dallas, Texas. What they're saying, for instance, in the complaint that Dr. Schreiber filed yesterday, he talked about cutbacks in nursing that have overwhelmed the nursing staff, and as a result, patients aren't being cared for in the way that they should be. So this was one of the complaints that he made to the health system was, you know, stop cutting nurses. We need more staff. We need better care for our patients. He also mentioned, you know, several other things in his lawsuit that have to do with cutting costs. And so I think that the dirty surgical instruments is kind of not really the central issue here. The central issue is a whole range of different cutbacks that these doctors say have resulted in declining quality of care at the health system. Not that the dirty surgical instruments are no longer occurring. They say that they are still finding them and they're still showing up in operating rooms. But they say that the root of the problem are these cost cuts that they say are motivated by, you know, profit motives. That is what they are alleging in their lawsuits.
And how has DMC or Tenet made any public statement in responding to these? You're on the bubble. If it's not cleaned up, you're losing funding. Has that been responded to in a public way at all?
Not really. I have posed that question to the DMC, and they haven't really directly, you know, they haven't provided a statement or a quote, you know, essentially addressing that issue. So although off the record, you know, they tell me that they believe that the health system will, you know, pass an inspection and be found in compliance, and they're confident that this will be resolved. So, but in terms of on-the-record statements, no, I haven't received any to that effect.
And in reading your reporting, these aren't the only two facilities that have kind of danced toward the end of the cliff with being in compliance with safety and inspection standards. Actually,
Receiving Hospital was scheduled for termination in October after an inspectioneer found a number of problems. For instance, they found that the hospital is no longer compiling, you know, infection control data because of staff cutbacks. And they were scheduled for termination, but just regained their deemed status last week, I think, that they reclaimed their status. So Receiving was sort of teetering on the edge. And after the 2016 report in the Detroit News about the dirty surgical instruments, actually Children's Hospital of Michigan was also threatened with termination. So this is four hospitals in the health system that have been threatened with termination of their Medicare participation since 2016.
Karen Biffard of the Detroit News tracking the unfolding problems at the Detroit Medical Center. Karen, always great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Coming up, Chef Edward Lee of the TV show Mind of a Chef is out with a new book called Buttermilk Graffiti. He visited cities across the country, exploring the intersection of food and culture, and yes, he came to Dearborn.
If I'm going to investigate and write about these people and their cuisines, I need to come at it from a place of humility.
That is in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for us to listen to some music being made in West Michigan. John Sinkovich is editor and publisher of Local Spins. And John, you've chosen three artists all based in Grand Rapids, and we're starting with electronic music coming from someone who began as a chemical engineer.
Yeah, and this is definitely an eclectic blend of music that I've selected for us today. Super Future, otherwise known as DJ Nick Rowland, is really an interesting story because he has sort of developed his own style. He definitely brings in live instrumentation into this electronic music scene, which has literally exploded over the last 10 years or so. So he's a guitarist who tends to bring those kinds of live instrument elements to the music that he creates, which has definitely got that pop flavor to it as well. His latest single, again, has already kind of earned raves, but this is after his 2018 single was released. It was called Endless Love, and it racked up more than 300,000 plays on Spotify. So really, this guy's definitely getting some attention. He's a native of Rochester, but he now calls Grand Rapids home, and he's certainly starting to play a lot of bigger shows. He played the Breakaway Festival here in Grand Rapids last year, and he's also the head of something called the Samsara Family Collective, which is a group of Grand Rapids electronic music artists which promotes shows and really trying to bring a new element to the scene.
What are you doing? I really wonder about it truly. When will I see you again? 'Cause it ain't been so.
you were saying he was a chemical engineer turned musician.
Yeah, I think music is one of those things that's impossible to hold down, and he certainly has made a name for himself here in the Grand Rapids area, and I think that's starting to spread. He'll be performing next on April 20th at Creston Brewery here in Grand Rapids with another electronic artist named Shuka, and he just headlined a huge weekend show in Holland with a whole bunch of different artists. He's definitely one of those guys to keep an eye on down the road.
And now we go to hip-hop and J. Rob. Tell us about him.
I've known J-Rob for many years. He's definitely a well-respected part of Grand Rapids hip-hop scene. He's collaborated frequently with stars like Lady Ace Boogie, who's also been featured on this show previously. I just played a major hip-hop showcase here in the Grand Rapids area as well. But what I really like about him is I like the message in his songs. He makes a statement, and at the same time, he has this very engaging style, very dynamic, and he really wants to pay homage to things like Fighting for the People, and he has a new track called Shake Up the World, and he just played a track on one of my shows here in Grand Rapids called Black Superhero that I think really is an uplifting piece of rap that I think needs to be heard by a lot more people. But his latest single is called Shake Up the World. About to shake up the world with it. About to shake up the world with it. That's from start to finish. About to shake up the world with it. About to shake up the world with it. From the line of scrimmage. Barely bragging, I'm toe tagging. Check out the fashion. I spit it like a fire breathing dragon. You hashtagging, I'm cash grabbing. I'm going up like the javelin, unraveling them. Can't nobody handle them. The gun don't never jam. What sets him apart in your mind? Well, I think it's because, as he puts it, he finds inspiration in everyday life and everyday struggles, so people can really relate to his message. I mean, he will say things like, he will rap about his son and bringing up his family. He'll, you know, rap about things that are really sort of pump up a crowd at a show at the same time. And as he puts it, you get everything with hip-hop. And with J-Rob, that really means this is life and this is what we can embrace.
Any new shows or new releases coming up that we can look forward to?
Yes, he has a new album coming out probably within the next couple of months. He says he's going to be planning a tour later this year.
All right. And now we go to a band called In the Valley Below, kind of an LA vibe to this band.
This band is literally on the way to stardom. This may be one of my favorite live performing bands in the Grand Rapids area. They actually moved to Grand Rapids from LA a few years ago and recorded their most recent atmospheric pop-hute album in their studio here in Grand Rapids. It will be released on Bright Antenna Records, and this band is also sort of an art rock band, and when they perform on stage, they have such a special chemistry from their fashion and the way in which they relate to each other on stage. It is really something to see. I fall into the darker side. I've loved and lost the best ones, yet I survive. Yeah, their new album is called The Pink Chateau. And to accompany it, they actually produced a full-length feature film. It's sort of a modern silent film, and it's an art project. And when they kick off their U.S. tour to promote this new album starting in Brooklyn on April 9, audiences will be able to watch this film while they're listening on headphones to the band playing the album live on stage. It's just another example of the innovation that they bring to their music.
About this couple.
So Angela Gail Mattson actually grew up in the Muskegon area, and Jeffrey Jacob Mendel met them. They actually made a big splash in Los Angeles a couple years ago with a single, Peaches. Actually toured internationally. They bought a house and then set up a recording studio in the basement here in Grand Rapids a couple of years ago and released their EP Elephant in 2017, which also got quite a bit of attention. They played a Grand Rapids show here in March just a couple weeks ago. They definitely are hoping to perform in Michigan again later this year, although there's nothing on the book right now.
You know, isn't this an interesting journey? It used to be that you'd get yourself started, let's say, in West Michigan, but you'd go to LA. Now it's working the other way. They're coming back.
I know so many bands and so many artists that have moved from bigger cities like Chicago, Nashville, New York, LA to come to Grand Rapids, partly because I think the scene is very collaborative. It's a lot cheaper. It's easier to maneuver. And I think they found that West Michigan is a great home and a great place to make music.
You can find out more about these and other West Michigan artists, as always, by heading to localspins.com, edited and published by my guest, John Sinkovich. It's always fun, John. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a great April.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We can all agree America is indeed a melting pot. So you think of what that means for the food we eat. Immigrants come to this country. They bring family recipes, traditional spices, and then hand those down through the generations. It makes for fascinating and delicious eating and many wonderful stories behind those dishes. And those are the stories Chef Edward Lee tells in his new book, Buttermilk Graffiti. Edward Lee is the host of the Emmy-nominated TV show Mind of a Chef. He's chef and owner of hot restaurants in Louisville, Kentucky and Washington, D.C. And he's the Brooklyn-born son of parents who immigrated from Korea. Lee took an epic trip across the country, exploring the intersection of food and culture, finding exceptional food in unconventional places, including Dearborn at Ramadan. Edward Lee, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What launched you on this road trip?
So this is how I eat. Whenever I travel to a new city, I always do the same thing. I always find the trendiest, the hippest, the coolest restaurant that's, you know, dominating the magazines, and I always eat there, and I always have a lovely meal. And then I talk to the locals, and I go, hey, find me that hidden gem, that little hole-in-the-wall place that everyone is going to, that everyone knows serves the best kebab or taco or pho, and I always find this incredible place. It's usually off the map. It's usually, hidden. I always get lost, and I usually have an incredible meal there. After doing this for a number of years, I've realized that, you know, the meal that I have at the trendy restaurant and the meal that I have at the hole-in-the-wall restaurant are equally satisfying to me. They're equally complex. The only difference is we write about one restaurant and one chef, and we don't write about the other one, at least not in the same glowing terms. And so I thought, what if someone did? What if we kind of flipped the model on its head and I went and discovered and ate at all these beautiful little ethnic hole-in-the-wall restaurants? And then we talked about it. We met the chefs. We talked about the food, got their stories, and sort of told this tale of what these restaurants mean in America. And that was the start of the book. And at first, I was worried that there wouldn't be enough stories or people wouldn't talk to me. And obviously, I was pleasantly surprised that not only were there stories, but they were really rich. And that's how it morphed into a book.
And you did. You went across the country. And I want to dive into your trip to Dearborn. Why did you decide to come to Dearborn?
So every chapter explores a different cuisine in a different location. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about Middle Eastern food that I find fascinating is that for most Americans, we've been eating it forever. We've been eating hummus forever. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been eating kebabs, shish kebabs, and pita sandwiches. That to me, they're almost American foods. They're very commonplace. And yet, we know so very little about it. For someone who's been eating hummus since I was 10 years old, I know very little bit about the culture that surrounds this cuisine. And so I really wanted to do a deeper investigation of what does it mean to come from, you know, Syria or Iraq or Lebanon? How is it that these ancient foods have survived for so long, you know? And what I didn't know about Dearborn, Michigan is that the Muslim community in Dearborn has existed for over 100 years. And so if there was a place that I was going to go to investigate this, that was going to be it. And I took a journey there.
And you made that 6-hour drive from Louisville. You were not eating on the road because you wanted to be hungry. So what'd you find when you got to Dearborn?
Well, I didn't do enough research, and I found out that I went right during smack in the middle of Ramadan, which is when the period when they fast. And so, you know, part of the research for me is not only eating the food at the restaurants, but also talking to the people in those restaurants, right? Really understanding their culture. Well, there was no one to talk to because the restaurants were empty because everyone was fasting.
Look at you like, you want to order food? And you were, I can tell you were just a little thrown off by that initial reception you got as you entered different restaurants.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's uncomfortable, and a lot for them too. They're looking at me like, what are you you know, what do you want? You know, because I've got a pen and paper in my hand. I've got my cell phone taking pictures. And, you know, it's awkward for them because they're like, they're not used to that. And so there's a, you know, revelation in the book that I have where I decide that I'm going to fast with them. And in that simple gesture, so I go to this restaurant, I order all this food, and I take pictures of it, and I ask them to box it up for me. And the lady says to me, says, why, you don't like the food? You haven't eaten it. And I said, no, I'm fasting because it's Ramadan. And she says, but you're not Muslim. I said, no, I'm not, but I'm here to write about your culture and your food, and I want to respect that, and I want to respect your religion, so I'm fasting along with you. And in that moment, her attitude completely changed, and she went from being suspicious to just completely open. She said, oh, my God, well, you got to talk to my husband. He'll tell you everything. And then I talked to her husband. She was like, well, you got to go to the mosque and visit these people. And all of a sudden, next thing you know, I'm being invited into people's homes. And it was a huge revelation. I'm glad I did that. That was one of the first chapters that I researched. And I'm glad I did it first because it really brought me to this understanding that if I'm going to investigate and write about these people and their cuisines, I need to come at it from a place of humility and respect. And I need to understand what each individual culture is and how you earn their trust. To walk into a place like that and just demand questions and answers, I realized was not going to work. And so I'm glad I got that lesson. You know, fasting wasn't easy for a chef who likes to eat a lot.
It was clear. You certainly felt the effects of 20 plus hours without food or water, and you write about that very clearly.
Yeah. But it was a great lesson. You know, it changed the book for sure. And it changed the way I look at people and food and forever. I mean, in that small moment that you learn something about yourself and you learn about how to interact with people that are different from you.
Well, I really loved the account that you write about going into the pastry shop, the Shatila Bakery, and a man walks up to you because he notices your pen and notepad and begins to talk. And his line was, you know, was so terrific about, you know, you don't learn Ramadan, you must experience it. And then he said, you said, what if I can't do this? I mean, I'm here to eat. And that is up to you, Mr. Writer. But what are you really trying to discover here? He changed everything for you.
He really did. And what I love about these adventures that you have when you go up, a complete stranger. And even though he was being a bit snarky with me, he took the time to sit with me. He didn't have to. He could have just ignored me and walked away. But he took the time to sit with me. Yeah. And in that very brief interaction that we have, taught me a really deep lesson about, you know, experience versus being a scholar. And, you know, I don't even know who that guy is, but I really have always wanted to thank him for kind of, you know, showing me that. And that's what I love about traveling. That's what I love about meeting new people. By putting yourself also in a place of vulnerability, you get to really test who you are as a person. You get to learn. And I think the ultimate goal of any of this for me is to just become a better chef, become a better person.
To that point, what are a few of the most memorable things that you ate while you were in Dearborn, or, and especially, are you cooking any of these things at home or in your restaurants?
Definitely. So to me, this was a project that it's not about restaurant food. You know, to me, it was just about understanding and learning who I am as a chef and what that means. So listen, I'm never going to cook Middle Eastern food at my restaurants. That's just not what we do. And I really don't want to disrespect the culture of that. But I do take these little nuggets of information and learning moments, and that changes the way. Now, I may not cook Middle Eastern food, but it's going to definitely change the way I look at cultural foods and the way I incorporate them into my restaurant. I mean, the food I had in Dearborn, I mean, gosh, everything from the pastries to a simple thing like hummus, right? And again, I go back to, I've eaten it a million times, and everything from a supermarket to a fancy restaurant. And to me, the way in which it's created there, the respect that it has, even the way it's plated is just, it's just different. And it feels different. And I truly, truly believe this. When you look at a dish and you see who made it and you get to talk to that person and you hear their stories, it makes the dish taste better. It just does. And because you cannot separate food from your emotion. And when you're in an emotional state, when you get to talk to these people, it makes you more emotionally sensitive. And so your taste buds open up. and the food tastes better. And that's what I cherish the most about, you know, the time that I was in Dearborn.
Well, it is a wonderful memoir, Edward Lee's Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. You get great stories, and yes, he does share recipes from across the country. Chef Edward Lee, we want to thank you so much for sharing your visit to Dearborn with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
After the break, a University of Michigan theater professor interviewed more than 100 people in Flint about that city's water crisis and then used those interviews to create a new play and...
to show that it really isn't just about the water. Flint has been dealing with a lot of things for decades, even centuries. Racism, poverty, violence, social inequity.
Using theater as a tool for social justice. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Flint water disaster has been reported on in great depth. Stories broadcast on radio and television, printed in newspapers, magazines, and online. Now comes another way to tell the stories of the people of Flint through theater.
Tell them I still got poison in my body. That every person in this city, they consider a nobody. Still got poison in their body.
I am here because this is where I am supposed to be. This community is my family, and we all need each other.
Those voices are from a new play, Flint, written by Jose Casas. He's an assistant professor of theater and drama at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. With us now, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for inviting me.
So you're from Los Angeles, and you were applying for this job at the University of Michigan, and that's when you learned of the Flint water crisis, which was really unfolding at the time. What led you to say, I'm writing a play about this?
Well, when I started hearing about it and starting to do more research, I was really, really getting more passionate, more angry as well. And all of my work actually is based on the idea of social justice, whether it's documentary theater or theater for young audiences or hip hop theater. And so while I was waiting to hear whether or not I got the job, I decided if I got the job, I would do the play. And I still could have done it technically if I hadn't been here, but I didn't want to do a hit and run and just come into Flint for a few days and leave and do a play. That's just not right. And with this type of ethnographic or documentary style theater, there's certain ethical considerations.
Such as?
In terms of, you know, how do you create art in the midst of trauma? You know, how do I go in and not cause more harm than good? And one of the things that's become communicated to me by a lot of people is that so many people are going into Flint, whether they're artists or researchers or lawyers, and a lot of people just feel like guinea pigs. They're like, why are you really here? Is it really to help us, or are you just, you know, it's the hot thing to do, and I didn't want to be one of those people. So
we certainly saw that during political campaigns.
Oh, yeah.
Flint was everyone's favorite backdrop.
And where we're doing, it's funny that you mentioned that, because where we're doing the community performance, they're like, we never hear from politicians until September or October of a voting year, you know, when they want to come in and do their speeches, so we don't let them because we know they're not invested. And so for me, it's also about when you do this type of work over an extended period of time is building trust with the community. So by myself, close to 100, if not a little bit more than 100 interviews, but I would say at least 400 people said no. And when people don't want to talk in this type of theater, you respect that as much as the people who do want to talk, because it's still painful, it's still happening, it's still continuing, possibly for generations. So it's not my intent to make people talk. It's whoever wants to share can share. And I don't know if I'd want to talk if I was in the same shoes. So you have to respect that as well.
So the play Flint, it's a series of character monologues?
It's a series of monologues, a couple of group ensemble scenes, and a couple of movement scenes as well. And the characters are fictionalized, but most of the monologues do stem from the actual interviews. And a couple of the monologues or scenes are composites of different interviews put together to create that character. But the dialogue is 100% from the people of Flint, as well as a couple of instances of public records that I was able to use as well. But it's 100% verbatim, the dialogue.
So when you say people of Flint, and who else? Do we hear from politicians? Do we hear from a Dr. Mona kind of?
One of the one of the characters is based on Dr. Mona, and we couldn't necessarily get an interview with her, but she gave us permission to use any material, TED Talks or whatever, to you. She's been great. It's just she's been so busy. And in terms of politicians, man, they don't want nothing to do with this play. They don't. We've asked them all. And
why?
So I don't think they want to be accountable or be in a space where they're accountable. And I think they don't want a perception of who they are.
You know, you talked about the ethics of what you're doing with kind of writing a play like this. Are you allowed to pull quotes from, you know, on the record interviews and things that
were said
by officials?
I did the research on the copyright laws, and that's a public domain. So it's good to go.
So are there officials represented in your play based on interviews that were given at the time?
No, actually. But there's dialogue from the people who do talk about those politicians. And so they're it's fair game. And especially Rick Snyder does not come off good whatsoever. He's one of the main targets in this. You know, him and Nestle, other corporations as well, are targets.
Let's listen to a couple of other clips from Flint, written by Jose Casas.
In a developed country, we should not allow water to pass over poisoning substances. It is just that simple. And while we're talking about how much it's going to cost, what we're not talking about is how much we have to gain by fixing the problem. But that is not the attitude. Nothing is getting fixed.
For those of us who don't drive nice cars and live in fancy houses, we ain't got much choice. Some people too afraid to leave. Some people can't afford to leave, and some don't know any better. Flint, all we got.
So tell us about, you've got a premiere this weekend and next weekend at the University of Michigan.
Yes, we open this Thursday, April 4th, and it runs for 2 weeks. We also, because it's a play about a community in crisis, to just do the play at the university would be unethical as far as I'm concerned. So I've created a bunch of events to contextualize the play and just create spaces for dialogue. So we have a symposium with a whole bunch of different sessions, panels, lectures, play readings, workshops that will be at the University of Michigan in the Walgreen Drama Center, April 4th and 5th. We have an art exhibit where most of the art is from members of the Flint community, and that is at the Duderstadt Art Gallery at the University of Michigan from April 7th through 11th. Obviously, we had the community performance on April 16th at the Flint Development Center. And finally, the Duderstadt Video Center, we're doing a live stream performance for those people who don't have access to come to this show. But in particular, in Flint, those who don't have access to transportation, those who are physically immobile, we want to try to get the word out to as many people as possible. And so, because we want this play to continue and to inform people about not only Flint, but there's a whole lot of Flints popping up in this country, and we need to deal with those too. And to show that it really isn't just about the water. Flint has been dealing with a lot of things for decades, even centuries. Racism, poverty, violence, social inequity. And so those all play a factor in what happened in the water crisis.
Jose, is there an overarching takeaway that you hope people will get from seeing Flint?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, just an education of what's happening and an awareness that it's, like I said, not just about water, all these different issues, but there are so many different communities being affected. And in the media, usually we only see predominantly poor African Americans, which is true because they're the largest population. But there are stories about how it's affected the Latino community in terms of immigration. There's a monologue about how the deaf community has been ignored. And I never would have imagined that starting this play. And so that education is one. And just this idea of change, that how do we in our own individual lives contribute to that, whether it's in Flint, here at the University of Michigan, or just in our own neighborhoods. I think, you know, if we're all too busy complaining about the world but never doing our little bit to kind of help the situation, are we part of the problem? So just having people think about change. And also, too, this play, I say in a lot of ways, when you break it down, it's a play about us taking things for granted, even a cup of water. You know?
The play is Flint, written by Jose Casas, who's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. Thank you so much for sharing your work and your passion with us, Jose.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate you getting the word out.
A recent report by the Associated Press tells us in the past 15 years, 1,400 newspapers across this country have gone out of business. To help understand just what's lost when a local newspaper goes under, we turn now to an editor and a publisher from two small-town newspapers in southeast Michigan. First, Jim Lincoln, publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. Jim's dad was the Herald's publisher going all the way back to 1957. So this is totally in your blood, Jim.
Yes. Yep. My parents moved to Tecumseh in 1957 and acquired the Tecumseh Herald newspaper. Been doing it since...
You're in the family business. Absolutely. Sarah Swanson is an editor at the Manchester Mirror, which she helped start as a blog in 2013. Now it is a print and online newspaper serving Manchester in western Washtenaw County. Good to have you here, Sarah.
Thank you.
It was according to a story in the Manchester Mirror, we see the town used to have a newspaper called the Manchester Enterprise, and then in 2015 it ceased publication. Why did you jump in there to help start a new community newspaper, which is now the Manchester Mirror?
We were just filling a gap. It was the thing that was most needed in the community at the time. So I went to a lot of different meetings. What was always talked about at the meeting was that there was no way to get the word out to anybody about anything. So nonprofit groups, nobody knew when any of their events were happening. Going to like village council meetings, it was hard to get anything out to anybody. Our community is, it's only a small percentage of people have high-speed internet access. So a lot of communities turn to online resources, which is not an option in the rural parts of Manchester. And so we stepped in to do this.
That is so instead of saying somebody ought to do something, Sarah Swanson said, I'll do it.
Yes. Yep.
Jim, coverage of national and statewide news, especially politics, dominates a lot of modern media. Why is that local perspective important?
I think locally, it's such a difference in terms of the way we receive particularly national news. Your big cable networks and the way that news is presented. So much is opinion-based now, and I think people gather facts based on someone's opinion rather than, you know, traditional journalism. I just find that, you know, when you read local newspapers, you're getting more of a straight approach.
You've said, Sarah, your newspaper's like a string around the edge of Manchester that forces people to look inwards. How so?
I really feel like having a newspaper helps us keep an identity as an independent community. It helps people remember that they're from Manchester. You know, it's got the obituaries, it's got history, it's got events. You know, we have all of the fundraisers for softball teams. We have, you know, the Lady Society chocolate potluck, right? This is the stuff that makes Manchester Manchester, and people wouldn't know to go to it if they didn't have the paper to tell them.
And it would die.
Yes.
The potluck supper wouldn't happen if people weren't there to support it.
Yes. So we had a two-year gap when the old historical newspaper stopped before we went to print from being online only. And it was a serious issue that community events didn't have the attendance.
We're talking about running local newspapers and what is lost when a local newspaper goes under as we talk with Sarah Swanson, editor at the Manchester Mirror, and Jim Lincoln, publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. And Jim, you said you feel like you're still able to cover all the major bases when it comes to covering Tecumseh, but you've had to work twice as hard with a leaner staff, fewer pages in the paper itself. What else have you had to cut back on in terms of news coverage?
Tecumseh's surrounded by the village of Clinton to the north and Britton to the east, and we used to have correspondence in those communities. We just cannot afford that extension. We do cover those communities when there's major events and news. We're still encompassing that area, but you know, Tecumseh is really our main focus, and we do run on a leaner staff today.
As are papers everywhere, yes, no matter what the size. Sarah, what does your paper try to cover? Yeah. What is your staffing like? I'm wondering, are you able to make it to every local government meeting? And what do people lose if you can't?
So right now it's mostly me and Marcia Chartrand, who has actually had a long history in newspapers. She was the editor of the Manchester Enterprise, and she and I do half of the writing each. We mostly focus on news articles. So that's meant that we've left sports out completely because we would need a whole nother person in order to do that. We're looking at growing in that direction. But it is basically news. And actually, covering the government meetings, we have five municipalities that we try to cover. It's four townships and our village. And it's hard. And we're trying to figure out how better to do it. And it's having better relationships with the township supervisors. We're building relationships. We have a very good relationship with the village, so we can get whatever we need from them. One of our goals down the line is to record all of those meetings and put them on the internet or stream them, just because we can't physically attend all of the meetings and cover them.
But it's a way of offering what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, journalists love to talk about the Fourth Estate and how informing voters through the press is crucial to a functioning democracy. How do you think it affects voters and politicians when there are fewer journalists, especially journalists writing about issues that affect local communities?
Well, that's very concerning. I mean, I think journalists can be government's best friend. I mean, we're there to help maintain credibility and trust. I mean, you lose the trust with your constituents, you're jeopardizing your whole government process and how effective you are. I know Sarah mentioned earlier about building relationships, and that is so important. And having trust with your school administration, with your city government, as well as your business community. I mean, you really are. In small towns, you work together.
And does that, Sarah, turn down the fire of political polarization by everybody knowing that they've got a place to go to for what you work to be? You work very hard to make this impartial, it's not cable news. You are here to say, here's what's going on. Here we're presenting you the facts, and people feel that they can write in and they can share opinions. Do you think that turns down the fire that this country is kind of burning under right now with polarization?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's something that I've noticed as we've gone along. Local issues almost never break down along conservative and liberal lines. So what happens is we have really contentious issues. One of our townships tried to pass a bill to build broadband themselves. That was like 6 months of uproar, but it did not fall down at all along Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative lines. And so what these issues do, they're issues that I don't think people would even be aware of, or at least to a much more limited extent, if it wasn't in the newspaper every week. It makes strange bedfellows. So you find yourself lined up with people that you don't agree with politically on a larger scale.
Well, I'm thinking of not a small local paper, but the Washington Post has at that masthead, when you go on their website or you read the paper, democracy dies in darkness. And it feels as though you, working in at the local level, keeping these local papers alive, are doing what you can to make sure that light's still,
mm-hmm.
still going.
Absolutely.
There. If we were sitting here 5 years from now, where do you see the Tecumseh Herald?
I see us still printing. I think newspapers have proved to be resilient over the decades, facing radio, facing TV, facing probably its biggest challenge with the internet and the new distribution of information. I think people are going to look for what is most credible for them. And I think it's going to come back to your local source, the source that's in your backyard, the people that you work with.
Sarah, where do you want to see the Manchester Mirror in 5 years?
Well, we've been growing this whole time. I hope we can continue to grow. I would like to see us be a 16-page paper with lots of advertising, fully self-supporting, so that someday I can retire. I don't know if that's where it would be, but that would be my goal.
Sarah Swanson, editor at the Manchester Mirror, Jim Lincoln, publisher of the Tecumseh Herald. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson.
Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, and Razi Joffrey. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.